Good evening. I hope you all enjoyed your meal. Well, arahanui ki te tangata, blessings to the people. And this idea of backwards into the future fascinates me. The idea that sometimes we need to see where we've been in order to get a bead on where we're going to. And sometimes we need to look back into the past and look at what's been swept under the carpet to make sure that lumps aren't left there for the next generation to trip over. And it's almost like we're a little late in history. It's like we've kind of swept a little bit too much under the carpet, and it's coming to the surface, and it falls to us in this generation to look around and decide, how are we going to approach this? Are we going to call in the cleaners to have a look under there and see whether we need to have a bit of a spring clean in order to be able to do that? Or is that our business? Is that a very personal thing that we need to look at our own lives sometimes, and our own attitudes and our own thinking and our own history? Do we have a right context? In other words, do we fully understand what has happened in this country down through the years? We are such a young country. And, you know, if you look at a place like Europe, they're still dealing with stuff that was swept under the carpet 400 years ago with boundary changes and all the rest of it, and it's a mess. I would hate to think that Aotearoa in 20 years or 30 years still hadn't dealt with some of the things which are very basic to our health as a nation. And this idea of backward into the future is kind of like a whakatauki or a proverb that appears in the prophetic book of Jeremiah. And he's talking about a time in history when the Jews were in captivity in Babylon. "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Not for evil, but for good, plans to give you hope and a future." And he's saying this to people in captivity, broken people who've been taken away from their homes and put into a really difficult situation. And it's like the prophet Jeremiah is saying, actually, I want you to prosper in this place that I've brought you to. And even though you might not like it, even though it might be uncomfortable, if you prosper and you make this nation prosper or this city prosper where you're being held captive, everybody will prosper. And people will remember that you actually made the difference to turn this opportunity of being kept in slavery and captivity into an opportunity to transform this nation. And when the right time comes, I'll sort it out. In other words, it's God's business. And I see this Māori whakatauki, which excites me. It says, "Kia whakatō mori te haere whakamoa. My past is my present, is my future. I walk backwards into the future with my eyes fixed on the past." And then I go back to Jeremiah, and that word future, aharet, means exactly the same thing. It means I'm looking to the future, but I'm aware of what's happened in the past. I carry the past because I know who I am, because I know my genealogy, I know my whakapapa, I know where I've come from, I know that God's given me a mission in life. How do I carry that forward into the future with a sense of identity? Now, that's exciting to me. There's a sense that if we know who we are, then what we invest in the future has purpose, has meaning, and a sense of destiny. But if we don't know who we are, and we don't know where we've come from, and we haven't taken the time to understand the history of the place that we live in, or where we've come from, it's very difficult. It's like starting all over again. If I go to a new place, the first thing I want to know is, what's happened here? And a lot has happened in Taranaki. And we want to talk about that a little bit tonight. But I want us to use our prophetic imagination. I heard a guy called Walter Brueggemann, who's a Presbyterian Old Testament scholar, use that term, and it excited me. It said, don't just read the words that are on the page as if they apply to the time in which it happened. Let it resonate with you in your heart and see how you can bring that forward into the circumstances you face now. In other words, all those Old Testament stories, and the New Testament tells us this, are foundational. They give us an understanding understanding. They give us some context of what's happened in biblical history, but prophetically they keep rolling on and on. So what is history telling us today? What can we learn from all these stories that we've heard of, from the Bible stories or from the stories of our country? History's not dead, it's a living thing. And tonight, as we gather here, we're making history. Because we're having a conversation, we're talking, we're thinking, hopefully we'll get a refreshed view on history, and we'll make history because we'll go out and we'll have these conversations with each other. And God, you know, this idea that God has put from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and he's determined their pre-appointed places and times, the boundaries of their dwelling, so that they should seek God, though he's not far from each of us. I love that. History is an investment in the future. God has a plan for us, our nation, and our city. So what's the plan that God has for the city, and how can he use each of us to advance that as peacemakers, as members of the body of Christ, or even as members of the community? We're all involved. There's a lot of positive things about Taranaki, and I'll tell you what, I'm going to take my jacket off. It's been unseasonally warm, hasn't it? I must just be warming up. But look at this. You know, you've got an amazing coastal walkway out there. I used to drive through Taranaki years ago, and it was pretty boring. There was a lot of old, broken-down buildings, and you'd drive along there, and you could see things poking up from the coast. But look what has happened. The whole focus of the city here has turned around to face the ocean. People love walking along that coastal walkway. The Lenlai sculptures. This place is known for his amazing sculptures, you know, wobbling in the wind and little lights flashing, and it gives the inner city some creative character. I walk around and I see paintings on the walls. New Plymouth's starting to get a real character. There's a real sense of excitement happening here. This is not a dry old agricultural service town anymore. It's getting some sense of a feel of going somewhere, and that's what history is about. Pukeariki, you can go there, and they do a great job of telling your story. The Govett Brewster Gallery, you can stand outside that and look at your own reflection. You know, there's artwork there shining back at you. Look at me. Wow, I'm all wobbly. But inside, what a stunning place that is to go and visit and enjoy. Pukekura Park, the lights, the concerts. Paula and I saw the Doobie Brothers there. And, you know, what a great place. Your economic performance as a region, just stunning, really. WOMAD. The world music, representing all the cultures from around the world, coming together, playing their music, people coming together. Tom Cruise, you know, that was the big thing for a while, wasn't it? Tom was here, The Last Samurai. And I just want to say there are some people that seem to have been missing out of our story that deserve more honor than they've been getting, who are local heroes in the story. And that might be Parihaka, that might be Tohu Kakahi, and Te Whiti o Rongomai. Amazing people who established a world-leading peaceful resistance movement right here in Taranaki. And Wiramukingi. Who knows about Wiramukingi? Anybody here? You ought to know about him. He's a local hero. So I think I need to have my clicker there, and let's just go on. You know, look at this is the Westpac Stadium in Wellington. What's right across the front of that? Look at that. The Raukawa, the three feathers that Te Whiti decided that they would wear in their hair at Parihaka, which has multiple meanings, including peace and including the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. This is exciting. And this is in Wellington. Waitara and Parihaka celebrated. Taranaki celebrated. Is Taranaki celebrating itself in the way that Wellington is celebrating and recognizing that story? I think it's time to reclaim, honor, and build on our foundational story. We had to get here, didn't we? And I may as well get this out of the way. You know, I just wonder, for whatever you think of Andrew Judd, he's a brave man. He's a brave man to have said what he said, whether it was a wise way in which he said these things or whatever, it has stirred something up. And, you know, I think probably things get misunderstood as we're trying to articulate difficult things, And I remember Paul Holmes a few years ago, what did he say about Waitangi Day? He said, it's a dreadful day. It's a disgrace to the nation. Our real nation-making day is Anzac Day. That's what we should celebrate. Let's get rid of this white. Let Māori have it. And I thought, oh, dear, what have you just said? And, of course, that was taken to the press council and he got scolded. Sometimes these public figures, when they are looking for ratings and sort of missing the context, can get themselves into trouble, but they can spark a discussion. And when I saw Andrew Judd's story on Seven Sharp, and Mike Hosking's spoiled it at the end. He was telling the story, and then he said, oh, this guy's out of touch with middle New Zealand. I go, oh, what did you just say? Who's middle New Zealand anyway? And how dare you speak for us? Am I us? I'm probably lower New Zealand now because we've got this class system where more and more people are struggling. So, you know, we don't know what's the middle or the end. And that was a very confusing statement to have made. Now, he's being challenged because of something that Andrew said. And then he tacked his comment on the end. And now this has kind of gone viral. This has kind of got people thinking around the country. So has Andrew Judd sparked an opportunity for a sensible discussion about a lot of issues that face this nation? And why would the mayor of Taranaki, of New Plymouth, why would he be saying something like that? Well, actually, maybe it is prophetic because a lot of things started here and a lot of things came back here and a lot of the pain that exists amongst Māori in this nation resides in this area. So maybe God, in his own mysterious way, is actually bringing things back to New Plymouth in order that it might be resolved. Are we ready to resolve it? Are we ready for that discussion, for that conversation to happen? And here's what Andrew said. I read this, actually it was in your local newspaper when I came with my wife Paula. We came down for Christmas in Taranaki. My daughter lives here and my two granddaughters now, and Paula's got history here, and we came and had Christmas here, and I found this column. He said, we live in a bicultural country where tangata whenua also have a view. Where is their voice? To not know and be ignorant is one thing. To see it and realize it and still ignore it is a whole nother level of ignorance. And it's pretty sharp words. I went out to Parihaka. I got asked, well, I thought it was time I went, because in my book, Beyond Betrayal, there's three chapters in there about Parihaka and how it came about and Waitara and what happened there, and they were the hardest chapters that I have ever written. I think I was in tears several times trying to get to the truth of this and rechecking and double checking, and it broke me up to think that this was our history in this country. And I published the book, and of course, if you publish something about Parihaka and you don't ask their permission, you're going to get into trouble. So I thought, all right, my turn. I'll go and sit. And I went with Graham Carley and another friend who've been going out there for years trying to maybe have Parihaka Day instead of Guy Fawkes. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? That'd be an interesting transposition of a foreign festival with a local meaning. So Alistair Rees and Graham Carley have been doing that. So they took me out there, they introduced me, and sure enough I got told of, you Pākehā writing about our history, how dare you, you didn't come and ask us. And I thought, actually, I deserve this, I'll take it on the chin, and then I became their friend. You know, it's the way that conversations happen sometimes. Māori are a very dramatic people. And if we don't understand drama, if we don't use our prophetic imagination, we'll miss the point. Oh, don't you talk to me like that. I'm walking out. Well, what an opportunity would I have lost? I spoke to Mata Wharekura this morning on the phone. We were going to meet up. And I said, oh, you know, well, maybe next time. And she said, well, I'll put you on the mailing list and make sure you drop in. And it's good. I've found some new friends. And so has Andrew Judd. Right in the midst of all of this, they rang up and said, Andrew, we see you're getting a bit of stick out there for sticking your neck out. Do you want to come out for Christmas dinner? And he did. And he went out to Parihaka and talked his head off. And they just laugh, but, you know, they're saying now, as Marta said to me on the phone this morning, she said, you know, Andrew has a lot of support among Māori throughout Taranaki at the moment. Something's really happening. And she agrees that he has become a catalyst to get the country talking about important things. So whatever that is, whoever spat at him, who cares? Sometimes the prophets get treated badly, whether he's a Christian, whatever he is, he stood up, he spoke the truth. Sometimes when you speak the truth, you get stabbed in the back. But if you really do hold that mantle, then God can use you. He can use anybody to speak the truth. And I think he was a truth speaker. It might not have been in the most eloquent or adequate way, but that conversation can happen now. It's like somehow the pressure's come off and we all want to talk about it. Can we talk about this sensibly? Let's have a look at the story. Some context is important always. So we've had the missionaries arrive in 1814. We've got 26 years of constructive, peaceful relationship building. We have a literacy revolution virtually happening by about 1834. The Bible's being printed in Te Reo in the Māori language. Māori are picking this up. They're taking it to their own people. But all of this is happening in the midst of chaos. The missionaries have come to Aotearoa in the midst of the musket wars. Muskets have arrived here, and instead of hand-to-hand combat, we are now picking off our enemies at a distance and getting better and better at it. And this idea of utu, which means that you did something to my people some time ago. This is a long memory. We're going to get it back. We're going to get you back for that. This has been going on for generations, and now it has accelerated. The missionaries have arrived in the midst of the musket wars, a very dangerous time. They cannot even move out of the Bay of Islands in the far north because it's too dangerous for them to do so. But what is happening as a result of these musket wars, these hundreds and hundreds of muskets, which now become the primary means of trade. Māori previous to this were selling goods. They were selling wheat, they were selling pork, they were selling flax, they were selling trees. They were an incredibly industrious people making money from the visiting trading ships that were coming. But now the wars have escalated, and the most important valuable item is muskets, and these musket acquisitions determine the power of powerful chiefs. So Hongi Hika, of course, was smart enough to go to England and say, well, I'm here to help translate the Bible and all the rest of it. And the king happens to hand over some jewels and all the rest of it. And he and a few others conspire, and he comes back with about 500 muskets. So very smart man. But that also escalated the devastation across wide territories of Aotearoa. And of course, with Hongi Hika doing all the damage up north, Te Rauparaha is at Kawhia. He comes down south through Taranaki to Whiruwhiru in the middle of the island, and Waikato and Te Waharoa. These are powerful chiefs who, getting musket power, start to get their own back on their enemies. Te Huihu and Taupo and other chiefs are creating fear across the country, and the traditional tribal territories are being broken. People are moving out of their traditional areas. You have a great scattering. So this is the context into which our story emerges. Taranaki engage with Waikato tribes. There's a lot of warfare goes on, but they actually realize they don't have anywhere near as many muskets or firepower or ability to be able to fight back. They do the dirty a couple of times, and I think they use Dickie Barrett with the rescued cannon off the ship that was sunk, and they fill it full of nails because they've got nothing else, and they blast them with all these nails, and then they virtually say, guys, I think we'd better get out of here because these guys are coming back for us. So there's two heki. One goes with Te Rauparaha down to the Kapiti coast, down to the top of the South Island and to other parts of Wellington, and the second heki, the first one's led by Te Riri Tafongafonga, who is the father of Wiramu Te Rangataki, or Witi Te Rangataki. They go and settle down further down the country, but no, the Waikato do not come and settle here. In other words, this is not now Waikato land because they took over. It's kind of open. So what's happened at the other end? Just during the musket wars, up to 20,000 Māori were killed. They killed themselves. and thousands of slaves were taken. The whole balance of power and boundaries have changed. So during this period of time, the slaves that are taken, a lot of them end up in the mission schools in the far north, and they learn the gospel. They pick up this gospel. And as a very oral culture with long memories, a lot of these guys can remember their whakapapa going back many, many generations. They know their stories. They know their history intellectually. This is all retained. So a lot of these guys are actually picking up the Bible stories and going, actually, we can relate to that. Actually, that sounds like some of our stories. There's a bit of a revelation going on. These are exciting stories. They like these colorful Bible stories. And as they're released and they've learned about Jesus Christ and they've learned about the concept of forgiveness, which is relatively unknown, because every aspect of Māori in terms of utu or reciprocity, there's a price to pay. But Jesus Christ on the cross paid once and for all, so we don't have to go back and get our enemies back because the price has been paid. This is a fresh idea. And as the slaves go back to their own people, they bring the message and Māori are evangelizing themselves. And among those guys is Huhepa Ripahau, who comes from Waitara. He originally comes from just up the way here. He was also known as Matahau, and he was going back down to his people at Waikanae. And he's a critical guy because all of these stories start to link together in an exciting way. So he heads off through Rotorua, and there's been a bit of a raru-raru, a bit of a breakout. There'd been peace in Matamata, and there'd been a little invasion between Rotorua there and this little, you know the story about Tarori, the 12-year-old girl who had a little kitty bag around her neck with the Gospel of Luke that was printed by William Colenso only the year before in the far north. An exciting story. And Ripahau comes across this Pauro Tioita, who's killed Tarori. And Pauro's saying, what is this book I've got? And Ripahau reads it to him, and he's pricked in his heart. In the book of Acts, when they had the Holy Spirit come, people were pricked in their hearts. Something changed, something challenged them deep inside themselves. Oh, that's me. I need to change. Something happened to this guy, and he asked for forgiveness. And he went back to Tiruri's father, Wirimu Nākuku, and asked for forgiveness. A revolution started there. This was what came out of this was a peace pact between those tribes that were at war. So then Ripahau heads off back down to Ōtaki, to Waikanae, and he talks to Tamihana, Te Rauparaha, or Katu, and Matini Te Whiwhi, and Riwai Te Ahu, who was the first Māori minister, and Wirimu Te Rangataki from Waitara, who's down there with his dad, who's been part of the second heki from Waitara to go down to Waikanae. And Wirimu Te Rangataki is excited with this gospel message. And Tamihana and Matini Te Whiwhi, Tamihana's the son of Te Rauparaha. And when he gets this message, he's going, actually, Dad, I'm not going to go to war anymore. I've read the gospel. Something's changed in my heart. I'm not going to follow you. I'm not going to follow in your footsteps. I'm not going to follow your fearful reputation where you've done all this damage down the South Island and where you've held people in fear of you because you're such a heavy dude. I don't want to be that kind of person. In fact, eventually he goes down to the South Island and asks for forgiveness. So we don't want to get too sidetracked, but this guy, Wirimu Te Rangataki, I want to follow him. So these guys, I call them the Kapiti Coast Bible College. They started to talk about the gospel of peace down there, and Te Rauparaha says, listen guys, it's not a good time. I'm about to go to war. If you continue to talk about this gospel of peace, I will burn your books. So they head off to Kapiti Island, about nine of them, and they study. And they learn the Bible, and they learn their own language in a written form and send off for some more material. And they've really got quite excited about this whole new gospel. We need a teacher. So off they go to the far north, and who's just arrived is this guy, Octavius Hadfield. He's a sickly, tall, pale guy. He couldn't even get himself ordained as a minister because of his illness, but he had some good contacts. So in Australia, he came across a bishop there and got ordained, became the first to be ordained in New Zealand. They got him in through the back door, and then they put him teaching the kids of the missionaries. And he said, that's not what I came here for. You know, if I'm going to die, I want to get out amongst it. I want to be part of this. So these two guys, Tamihana Te Reopraha and Matani Te Whiwhi, arrive in the far north and say, we want a teacher. He says, send me. I'd rather die down there amongst the Māori than stay up here teaching the missionary kids. I signed on for an adventure. And he's only 23. He's a young man full of vigor and, vim and vigor and all that V stuff. He's drinking V. Actually, it probably wasn't, but laudanum, I think, was what he had, because he was pretty sick. But this guy lives to be 90 years old and becomes the conscience of the nation, for goodness sake. He stands up for Māori when nobody else will. And you know who one of his friends is? Is Wiramu Kingi. So he's, what did he say? Whiti Terangataki is his name, 1839. He welcomes Hadfield. Hadfield goes and lives in his pa in Waikanae. Thank you. Keep missing that one. But it's an amazing story. So Hadfield stays in his pa and baptizes Terangataki and Huhepa Ripahau, this guy that's been around the country preaching the gospel. This is an historic occasion. So the guy gets baptized and has his friend. Wiramu Kingi takes the name, Whiti Terangataki takes the name Wiramu Kingi, and I only worked this out lately. He took the name King George, because King George was the one who ratified the treaty of the independence, the Māori independence declaration, and the Māori flag. You know, the flag of King George that was ratified as the New Zealand flag for sailing on ships in 1835. Māori, apparently a lot of Māori, took the name King George or Wiramu Kingi at that time in honour of this British sovereign who stood with them as they declared their independence and as they agreed to have a single flag representing the Māori nation that would be flown on all trading ships that had Māori on board, because prior to that, those ships were getting confiscated because they weren't flying under a known flag. So he's named after the king who ratified Māori independence. And Hadfield said, Kingi's one of my closest and thoughtful Māori friends, an intelligent and vigorous leader, and an enthusiastic convert to the new faith. So this is the guy that's come from Waitara, that's gone down with his father, that's built a pā, and is already being an amazing influence. So Hadfield, over time, befriends and defends Māori for a long time. He's a trusted and proven friend, this Wiramu Kingi. He signed the Treaty of Waitangi, which was brokered by Christians. You know that story, don't you? There would have been no Treaty of Waitangi had not the missionaries convinced Māori that this was the right thing to do at this time in history. We've got to realize that the church is part of this. We can't sit on the sideline. There would be no treaty if the missionaries hadn't agreed and talked to Māori, and Māori didn't trust the missionaries. There wouldn't have been a treaty. And the treaty's all about partnership, protection, and participation. Those are the words that are used today that sum up all of those four clauses that so many people have been arguing over for decades and decades. It's simply this: partnership, protection, and participation. That's all Māori were assured, and that's what they want, to be equal as British citizens in every single way. That was the promise that was made, but within 4 years of the treaty being signed, just about every aspect of those promises had been broken. 1841, the New Zealand Company brings settlers into New Plymouth. They've taken over the debts of the Plymouth Company, but, William Wakefield's already come in before the treaty's signed. He was told not to come to New Zealand. He was told Britain has colonies enough. Māori were just campaigning to get some military effort to try and deal with the hassles that British sailors and whalers were causing. They did not want to colonise New Zealand. But when Wakefield, who'd been in prison and come up with all these fancy money-making ideas, decided to come out, sell shares in New Zealand before he had ever set foot here, to buy the land as cheaply as he could possibly buy it and sell it for the highest price possible. Sounds like a lot of real estate agents in Auckland, doesn't it? But this is the beginning of our troubles in Aotearoa, is this opportunist got signatures from chiefs that had no right to sell for boundaries that weren't clearly delineated for £500 worth of trinkets, including axe heads and tobacco and gunpowder and nails and whatever, and then proceeded to go up the coast and buy Taranaki. Wurumu Kingi's thinking, hang on a minute, this is my territory, this is where I come from, this is where the Taranaki people come from, we're down here, we left because it was dangerous, it's probably a good idea to have some settlers there, we agree to that, but leave Waitara alone. That's my blanket, that's for the future generations, don't touch that. He told that to Governor Gray, he told that to Gore Brown, do not touch my blanket. And his father, Te Rere, said to him on his deathbed, do not sell Waitara. This is the Christian man, this is Wurumu Kingi, who, when we had the first breakout of the land wars, which really started about 1843 in the top of the South Island on the plains down there, Wairau Plains, thank you. When Te Rauparaha and Te Rangitaki said to Wakefield's brother, don't touch this land, the Wairau, that's our land. And the part of the problem is that the New Zealand company had sold and marketed so much land in New Zealand. They'd done a whole marketing job. This is what you'll find. White picket fences, land all marked out for you. Everything will be here. There'll be jobs. There'll be this. There'll be that. There'll be all the rest of it. And when you get here, but there wasn't. They didn't have proper ownership of the land. They didn't have the land that they promised that they had. So there were settler ships arriving the moment that the New Zealand company had set foot here. They were already on the way, even though the British had said, no way, don't come. Even though the Church Missionary Society had said, no way, don't come. So the first problem was on the Wairau Plains when Te Rauparaha built a power on there and said, you're not coming on here. And he burnt down the surveyor's hut. And then they brought in all of the armed constabulary and thought they were going to put handcuffs on Te Rauparaha and Te Rangitaki. Not Te Rangitaki, the other, his cousin anyway. Two of the most powerful chiefs. You don't do that. And of course, 24 of those guys lost their lives. And they knew well that Spain, the commissioner, was about to come in and investigate all of these things, but they went in anyway. So everybody's on alert now. Hang on a minute. Are the British going to come in here and start taking Māori land by force? Rangitaki's watching that, and everybody else around the country is too. And Te Rauparaha's pretty upset because he's been embarrassed. In fact, he lost his daughter, and some of the first shot that was fired killed his daughter. That's why there was retaliation. So around about this point, he's deciding he's going to invade Wellington. But Wurumu Rangitaki says, actually, no. I'm not going to let your troops through because he's got land at Waikanae that won't allow Te Rauparaha's troops to come through. So he saved Wellington from an attack that could have been devastating. History could have been hugely different. So Te Whiti, Wurumu Rangitaki is a hero. He saved the day. Hadfield says it. Everybody tries to blame Hadfield and say, Hadfield, what a great job. You just say, no, it was him. It was Wurumu Te Rangitaki that saved Wellington from being attacked. Meanwhile, he's built the most beautiful church at Waikanae for all the Māori down there. And you know, it's honoured by Bishop Selwyn when he goes, this is fantastic. This church seats about 500 people. There's a whole revolution going on there. This guy's amazing. So, where do we go from there? We've got Honi Hiki having a hack at the whole thing's falling apart. And, Tafiti says, King, he says, don't touch Waitara. Honours his father's promise to his father that he will not let it happen. Governor Gray says, I don't want you back here at Waitara. Please don't come back. And he says, I'm coming back. And he said, well, if you come back, go to the north side. He says, no, I'm coming back to my family land. I'm the customary chief. This is my right. I get to make the decisions on behalf of the tribe. It's not my land, but this is the way that Māori work. You know this. But I'm coming back. I'm coming back to look after my land. So Kingi and 600 of his people begin their heki back to Waitara. So he's a friend, but greed can destroy friendships. And you've got Governor Gore Brown, who's not taken time to come and visit or to get to know the local politics or get to know how things work. And he's now responsible. He's replaced Governor Gray. And Kingi builds three pā at Waitara for 300 of his people. And what do? They're not angry. They're not annoyed. They just keep saying, don't sell our land. They work the land. They plant their crops. They've got all the implements. And they supply New Plymouth. They supply the settlers in New Plymouth with vegetables, with pigs, with labour. They're involved, like Jeremiah was saying. You know, you look after this place and it'll look after you. It's almost a prophetic kind of thing here. He's Kingi giving and giving and giving despite all the pressure, looking after the people, providing for the people, but the pressure continues to come on. The settlers are getting so angry because they've been promised this place that's going to be their new home, and it's nowhere near what it was. They're having to work hard to dig up roots and try and make, but they want that Waitara land because Kingi's farming it, and it's producing well. It's in a prime place by the river. It's a great spot, and they're not happy with where they are. So the pressure's on to get more land, but increasingly Māori are going, actually, you've taken enough of our land. There's a million and more acres across the North Island that's been taken, a lot of it under curious circumstances, so we actually need to do a bit of a tie-ho here, and we need to have a conversation. You promised us that we would be able to have equal rights as British citizens to be able to discuss what goes on here, and you told us that we didn't have to sell any land, that it would be up to the government to sell the land, and it's not down to individuals. So Gore Brown is conspiring to divide and conquer. And he finds this fellow called Te Tera, or Taylor, who'd been down in the Kapiti Coast and with Te Rangitaki, but he'd had a bit of an upset with his uncle, because Wiramu's his uncle. There was this woman that Te Tera wanted to marry, and she didn't like him. So she ran to her uncle, Wiramu Kingi, and said, will you protect me? And he said, all right, well, I don't like the idea of you being forced into marriage. So he gave Te Tera a white horse and a couple of $100 and thought that would be compensation enough. But Governor Gore Brown, seeing that there was a bit of an issue there, talked to him and said, well, are you prepared to sell this? He actually offered to Gore Brown the land at Waitara for £200. And the other government officers, they said, no, that's all right. He's got a legitimate right to it. So really what happened there on that day when Wiramu Kingi was saying, no, 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 I will not sell my land, Gore Brown said, all right, I accept it. That was the breaking of Wiramu Kingi's customary title that you didn't do. And all across the country, over in Hawke's Bay, where we come from, there were chiefs over there going, this is going to be trouble. This is going to cause problems. There's chiefs all around the country watching what the government is doing, dividing Māori up into individual sales, which has not happened before, to individual people. And the government's going, once we do this, we'll be able to do that with all Māori. We'll be able to buy land anywhere we want, anyhow we want. We will have broken Wiramu Kingi's customary title. So that's pretty sad, isn't it? So he buys the 600-acre Pika Pika block at the mouth of the Waitara River, and Hadfield is just, he's just livid. He's just so upset because he's been corresponding. He writes to England. He writes two little books, one of England's little wars when it gets going. Then he writes another of England's little wars. He's embarrassing Gore Brown in England amongst the high society to say, look what's happening in New Zealand. Something has happened that should never have happened at all. He says, the land wars were blundered into. So this is how it happened. 20th of February 1860, the surveyors put in the pegs to map out Waitara, and Wiramukingi sends out 80 old men and women, and I understand it was mostly old women, to pull up the surveyors' pegs. This is what Governor Gore Brown had been waiting for. He had already filed the papers in Auckland that there was going to be martial law. So he was ready for this. He was ready to bring in the troops. And what did it take? 80 old ladies pulling out the surveyor's peg, and then later on in a second time forcibly removing the surveyors off their land, and in come the troop ships. So Niger comes in the 22nd of February with the 65th Regiment, 500 military people set up a base on the disputed land, and Kingi's people see this little triangle up here, set up the L-shaped power. They burned, well, it was actually a combination of Māori and the troops that burned Wiramukingi's three power. And the thing that upset him most was that they burned his whare karakia, which contained boxes of his New Testaments. Burned down his village as a means to get him off the land. So he builds a little war power right at the very end of his land. And they're saying, you've got to get off this land. This is now our land. So they come in and they bombard it. First shot, 17th of March. Very important date. 224-pound howitzers. Look at these guns here. This is the 200 of those. 200 rounds from those just smashed it. But by the time they got there, there was nobody there. 3,500 troops now moving in. This is now a military frontier town. So the betrayal of a Christian friend. You know, we don't know too much about Wiramukingi, but when I see his integrity as a man, his attempt to honour his father's request, his attempts, his poetic and regular correspondence with Hadfield, his reasoned debates and discussions. And this is what Samuel Williams, over where we are, says, the Māoris here have said from the first that the Pākehā is like a set of porangis, idiots, or people who are mentally unwell, have fallen out with one of the best friends they had in the country. That resulted in 30 years of land wars. Not the Māori wars, I don't like that. Land wars, this is war over land. This is pressure to push Māori off land that is legitimately theirs, using every means possible, including getting them into so much debt in the attempt to defend their land or get groceries that land is forced out from under them. Within days, Wāria is bombed. Who's at Wāria? Whiti and Tohu, that's their pa at Wāria. That had been the mission station of Remenschneider, the North German mission teacher, who had walked into that place quite a few years earlier, and I think he must have been a boring teacher, because he was given that role, you know, and because it was a difficult place to go, and they'd said, well, you have a go, because a lot of other people have had a go there and not had much success. So he turns up there, and he talks to them about the gospel, and Te Whiti said to him, yeah, we've heard that message before. So set up a church for him, and he begins to teach. And I imagine it's like at church sometimes, there's a lot of these Māori, and they're going, what was that? Oh, sorry. And I think Tohu must have taken him aside and said, what's up, bro? You're pretty boring, and the people are going to sleep listening to you. Come with us and we'll teach you how to teach our people. So Remenschneider got taught by Te Whiti and Tohu how to teach his own people the gospel message. So they were his teachers. So You know, this is interesting, isn't it? The gospel message has gone out all around the country before even the Pākehā missionaries have got there in most places. And when Reverend Schneider gets there, Māori have to teach him how to teach them. And there might be something prophetic in that too. Maybe Māori have still got a lot to teach us. And I think there's some truth in that one. But anyway, Governor Gore Brown, there's a truce for a while, but what Hadfield did and all his letters and all of that got Gore Brown sacked, and he got sent off to Tasmania, where there weren't too many Aboriginals left to teach because the British had shot most of them. So he couldn't do too much. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that, should I? That's just terrible. That's disgusting. But he did. We got rid of Gore Brown because he caused a lot of problems. He didn't understand. He didn't listen. He pushed when he should have listened to missionary advice, when he should have listened to Whiti, to Wiremu King. He should have listened to him. And this is what happens with the Hongiheka up in the north too. All he wanted before he cut down the flagpole was, will you come and have a conversation with us, because what is happening is not what was promised. I put this flagpole up here from my own forest. I expect to see the Māori flag alongside the Union Jack at the very least, and all I saw was the Union Jack, and now you're taxing my trade. When I come into Korurareka to sell my goods, you're taxing me, and you're taxing all the... Now you're going to send the government to Auckland? Come and talk to us, Governor. Here goes another flagpole and another flagpole. This is the Māori drama. This is the poetry that we've got to put back in the story, and we've got to see that with Wiremu Kingi as well. He's talk about the blanket that should be preserved for his future generations. And later on when we talk about Parihaka, we're ploughing the land. Why are you ploughing the land? Because we want to see what the government says when we plough the belly of the nation. We're ploughing the belly of the government to get their attention when another injustice was happening. So all of this results, you know, we got Tamiana Te Waharoa, who's become a Christian in 1843, somewhere about there. Another chief's son who said, Dad, I'm not going to go to war because I've heard the gospel of Jesus Christ and I prefer the gospel of peace. They've got to bring an end to this war. I will not continue to carry on the utu that you have carried on for generations. And he comes down and tries to broker peace here in the Taranaki, and he gets into trouble for that. But there's a lull for a little while, and then it starts again, and then Governor Gray continues building his road down towards Ngāru Wahia, and he's insisting, no, I'm just repairing the road, it's just a trade road. And all these troops start coming down it, and the Māori King, who's been elected because Tamihana Te Rauparaha and Tamihana Te Waharoa are wanting representation for their own people, which has not been provided to this point, and what has been seen by Gray and by Gore Brown before, they're in rebellion, they're rejecting the Queen. These people must have their land taken from us. And Tamihana Te Waharoa continues to say, we do not reject the Queen. All we want is a voice for ourselves. And I've been trying to work out a form of government that might work. He had a place called Piria. He set up a pā there where if you were going to be part of that, you needed to know the Ten Commandments. You needed to respect the Bible, and you needed to work for your living. They had a post office. They had a communications depot. They grew wheat. They traded with Auckland. And from that, he worked out a way that Māori governance might work. And he went to see Gore Brown in Auckland and sat in front of his office door for 3 days watching people come in and out, asking, will you see me, Governor? I've got a good idea as to how we will stop Māori warring amongst themselves and with the British. Here's a really good idea. He said, I was ignored. He said, I felt treated worse than a dog. So then he went to see Te Whiriwhiri and said, will you become the first Māori king? He sat on that and he sat on that and he sat on that. And then they said, rebellion, rebellion. So here's Governor Brown's and then Governor Gray's idea. This is a good idea. Here's how we will get the land. You're either with the Queen or you're with the King. Māori didn't want to make that decision. If you're with the King, you move that. Well, our family's down there. If you're with the Queen, this side. So everybody's going back to their family, to Waikato. And in comes Governor Gray with 15,000 soldiers against 3,000 Māori, and it's all on. 1.4 million hectares confiscated in Taranaki, Waikato and the Bay of Plenty, 2,100 Māori and 800 troops killed during that dreadful time that started here at Waitara. So I told you about Tamihana. I tell you what, this stunned me. This book here is a wonderful book, Tamihana the Kingmaker. And I'd been after it for ages, and I think I bought it online. And this is, you know, this, we're having this debate at the moment, aren't we? Why don't we teach our history better? Why don't we teach about the land wars? Why aren't our kids aware of what's going on in this country? And the story is, well, we don't have to, but if you want to, I'm not sure that's good enough. I'm sure that the correct, it wouldn't take much, would it, to give a simple explanation of what's going on here rather than learning how Harold got an arrow in his eye in 1066 or all the British history that's really not contextually of much use to us. I want to know, I got excited and saddened and broken and hurt, and when I saw the gospel side to this with people like this, I thought there's hope here. These guys were gentlemen who believed in the gospel wholeheartedly, who stopped doing what they used to do and found a way to honour God amongst their own people and lift up Jesus Christ and become ambassadors in times of great war. But in this book, this is Waimati. Everything happened up in the Bay of Islands, didn't it? And Waimati was where the missionaries were. And this book in 1968, this book no longer meets the curriculum needs or student interest requirements. I thought, what? This is a beautiful book by L.S. Rickard. And that was tossed out of a school library way back then. Are we still doing that? Come on, I carry this around just as an example of what our, we don't need to know about all that stuff. I think we do. I think we've got to lift the carpet up and start looking again at what's under there so the next generation isn't caught up with the same confusion that we're facing right now about not knowing our own history. So when a debate comes up like Andrew Judd, we go, oh no, what a prat. Oh no, how embarrassing that he would say these kinds of things and embarrass it. Well, hang on a minute. He's opened an opportunity for us to have a discussion. It may not be a discussion about Māori wards. It may be how do we have better representation in order that the Māori voice is heard and that the pains of the past are addressed and that we look again at our history in a more healthy way in order that we can stand together as two peoples for the benefit of the region. Because if you set the tone in this region and you get it right, the rest of the country is now watching. And if we're Christians, we're called to be peacemakers. And if we're Christians, we're called to listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit that sometimes says, close your mouth before you let it out, before you let it open without putting your brain into gear. Wait, listen more than you speak, because you might learn something. And wait. Sometimes people, you know, if I'm in a conversation with somebody and I see them getting bored or starting to yawn and looking over my shoulder for somebody more interesting to talk to, I think, actually, it's not going in, is it? They're not hearing me. They're not really interested in me. So, oh, okay, well, nice to meet you. Well, see you later. Yeah, okay, all right. I'll find somebody who might be interested. And sometimes it's hard. But I think our history should be interesting. So I told you all about this guy anyway. He had all his land confiscated in the end. And even today, they still use his Bible to crown the Māori king. And they have done for generations. And his son went on to use that same Bible. He said to his two sons on his deathbed, one of them, he said, what are you going to do to one of his sons? And he said, I'll get the Pākehā back for all they've done to you. And he said, okay, what does the other one say? And he said, I will carry on being a peacemaker in your stead. Well, you'll be the next kingmaker. And he was. And he went to England with the next king, and he also went to England with Tahu Potiki Wiramuratana some years later. These things, we have a connected history. I call him a peacemaker, a poet, and a statesman. And this is what he said about Kingi. Kingi was a man of calm thought. He was misjudged, and in rushing in madly to fight with him, the government made a mockery of claims the country and people were one. The place of worship was burned in a box containing testaments. All was consumed in the fire. The cattle were eaten by the soldiers. 100 horses sold by auction by the soldiers. It was this that disquieted the heart of William King, his church being burnt by fire. Those are the words of Tamihana Te Waharoa, quoted by Taylor and cited in that book by Rickard. Powerful words. Hey, he was hugely respected, this hero, this local hero. So when the dust dies, you know, history, sometimes it takes a while for history to make sense. We, in the midst of it, we can't see what's going on. We're in the midst of a technological revolution now that is changing everything we know about the way things work. It's changing every industry. It's changing the way we communicate, social media. We're in the midst of a revolution, but we can't quite see it. And when things, in 20 years' time, historians will look back and be able to make some very interesting conclusions about where we're at. So the New Zealand Herald, 150 years on, reflecting on its first edition in 1863, which was about the Waikato invasion, said the New Zealander of the year would be good Governor George Grey for peacemaking efforts, and he blamed the barbarous tribes, especially the King movement. Oops. So a few years later, in hindsight, Tamihana Te Waharoa, the kingmaker, the true peacemaker, would be New Zealander of the year. You know who I'd put in there alongside that, eh? Wiramukingi. I think a local hero in Taranaki, the man from Waitara who was so misrepresented for such a long time. And in the Atiawa settlement, it restates in 1927, the Royal Commission confirms Kingi's people were not in rebellion, and they repeated the Atiawa statement reading just recently, 16th of March. They repeated, and what was said in 1927, the natives were treated as rebels and war declared against them before they had engaged in rebellion of any kind, and in the circumstances they had no alternative but to fight in self-defense. In their eyes, the fight was not against the Queen's sovereignty, but a struggle for house and home. So I wonder, if you're living in Waitara, and you look at the street names in Waitara, and I did that before this was raised as an issue, and I felt sad. I felt virtually, Paula and I went for a drive through. I just felt I had to go, and it was just a sad, sad feeling about the place. You know, there was just like an echo from some place in the past where things hadn't quite been resolved, and I looked at the street names. McLean, the land commissioning officer in charge of all of that, Paris, who testified against Wiramukingi, saying, no, the Te Aru can sell his land. Brown, Gold, who was one of the military men, Craycroft, Ihaia, the one who stood with the crown against the local people. You know, I'm not sure what you do with that. I'm really not sure. But 20 years ago, it was recommended by the Waitangi Tribunal that name changes are needed. It is when leaders like Kingi, who understand the prerequisites for peace, are similarly memorialized on the land and embedded in public consciousness, that these names will cease to stand for conquest and the Waitara War will end. 20 years on, I understand it's just been ratified, there won't be any name changes on the streets because due process has somehow screwed it up. There wasn't enough discussion. There wasn't enough involvement of the right people to make the right decisions. And what we've ended up with is the status quo. It's not good enough. It's not good enough. Where's the church in this? I think the church should be engaged in writing and saying that this injustice cannot be seen to be perpetuated forever. We need to see something change. We need to honour people like Wiramukingi. We need to honour the other side of the story, not to be perpetuating this injustice without reflecting on what that is doing to the people who bore the brunt of that injustice at this critical place in time. Even Te Kohia, that place where that L-shaped pau was, overgrown and rotting, although I did see that there is a smart sign somewhere pointing to Te Kohia. But again, you know, it's an issue that needs to be addressed. And the ownership of that land and the arguments that keep going on about who owns it. And You know, in the midst of that, we've got this land wars. This money being given in the latest budget, hasn't it? I think $4 million to consider a commemoration for the land wars. I like the parihaka idea of a parihaka day. Rather than commemorating wars, there's got to be a conclusion out the other end that is much more healthy for all of us to say, yes, we recognize what went on and we want to honor both sides, not just the memorials, the endless memorials for the British soldiers and militia who were involved in that. Where are the memorials to the Māori whose land was unjustly taken? And the courts have said again and again and again that this was not confiscation. The land should never have been confiscated or taken. And so many of those land blocks were locked into in perpetuity leases, 99 years. Māori were never going to get their land back. And you know what the law said? If you do want it back, yep, you can have it back, but you've got to pay for all the costs of everything that's appreciated on that, including wool sheds and fences and everything that we've built on it. And of course, people can't afford that. So the land is lost. So there's another section to this, and I do tend to prattle on a bit, but I thought I would just have a glass of water and let you vent your pent-up frustrations or fire a question or two, and if you want to, we'll move on to the next stage, which might make a bit more sense. I know I get excited, and we've been talking for quite a while. Have I talked for too long? No? You're all okay. It was probably better than some of the stuff that's on TV on a Saturday night. I hope so. Because I think TV should be doing a better job of representing us too. I look on Māori TV sometimes, and anybody see that show, The Prophets? The Māori Prophets? Māori TV does a great job telling their own history. We've forgotten it. We're all doing, rubbish. Anybody got any questions that at this stage? Any thoughts? Is that an Andrew Judd t-shirt? Fantastic. I'm a recovering. Are you?
I am.
Really? What brought you to? No, but it's too late now.
Sorry.
So what brought you to feel comfortable wearing that t-shirt, Andrew? I think it's touched. Who would ever imagine that Amir would have, you know, his own Facebook, you know, fan club? And there's something going on here. I don't quite get it, but I do think, I prophetic imagination, if we use that, maybe I believe in God. I don't know. Some of us don't, and some of us are much more rational about things. But when you put God in the picture, when you put spirituality into the picture, suddenly a whole nother dimension comes alive. And whether you're a believer or not, we're all still involved in a creative universe with a creative God who's looking for ways to get our attention. And maybe Andrew Judd's God's tool for this time to get our attention, to have an honest discussion that might be a little overdue. I'm excited to see what comes out of this and how do we deal with this. I worry that some of us might have a backlash attitude. Bloody Maori, there they go again, wanting more money and they want the land. But did you really stop and think that maybe that was their land originally and it was taken from them illegally and that all of this has been established in law and we're still arguing over something that's already been settled as if that part of history didn't happen? You know, we can get so emotional, but when we step back and put things into the right context, take a breath, what else is going on here? You know, I think that's always, what else, what's really going, Paula would say that to me, what's in God's other hand? And think you've hit a blank wall. Wow, I can't go any further. What's in God's other hand? He's always got something. You know, that Jeremiah quote, he has hope and a future for us. And that future is built on foundations that were established in the past in order that we might move on. My concern is that if we don't deal with this now, there are world affairs that are bubbling around that might overtake us and we might not get the opportunity to have this healthy discussion at this critical time.